Welcome to This Is Money podcast. I'm Georgie Frost, and alongside me and editor Simon Lambert today is pensions and investments editor Tanya Jeffries. And in their deftest Maradona move yet, will they go left? Will they go right? Note, the Bank of England just continued straight down the middle, but have they scored a worldie in the top left corner or missed an absolute sitter with the decision to hold rates again? Homeowners have breathed a collective sigh of relief, but is this the end of super cheap mortgage deals? And will this finally take some of the steam out of the red-hot property market? Ask Simon. Also today, those waiting for the state pension to start have been telling This Is Money of the hardships that they've faced. DWP said the situation has now been sorted, but has it? Former pensions minister and This Is Money pensions agony uncle Steve Webb joins us for that. Plus, the government bodges pension age changes. The Lords try to save the triple lock. And we delve into the crazy world of council tax. Don't forget, you can stay up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app. But first, despite all the noise, the Bank of England pulled a very Bank of England move and did not a great deal. Interest rates stayed at 0.1% this week, and the QE program also remained unchanged, $895 billion. It wasn't a unanimous decision, though. 7-2 split for interest rates, 6-3 for QE. But that's despite fears inflation could top 5% in April next year. So what gives, Simon? The financial markets, I believe, priced in a 90% chance of a rise, was it? So what happened? Did they bottle it, as I saw one press release suggested they might have done?
Good question. Did they bottle it? Or were people just getting totally ahead of themselves with the expectation that interest rates might rise? The question is, without the inflationary scenario that we've got at the moment, would you be putting up interest rates? Well, probably not. Actually, in my mind, even if we didn't have the inflationary scenario we have at the moment, we probably should be putting up interest rates. The base rate was lowered to 0.1% in the emergency cuts before the coronavirus crash, came down from 0.75%. Quite clearly, things in the economy are not as bad as we thought they were going to be when the base rate was cut to 0.1%. I do think that the base rate needs to be higher than 0.1%. I think interest rates need to be off the floor, and I think that the economy would be perfectly capable of handling it. But what kind of weird scenario would you be in where you might raise them without the inflation problem, but you wouldn't raise them for the inflation problem? Well, the thing is, the reason why I don't think raising interest rates would do anything to tackle the inflation problem is the inflation problem, I'm not entirely sure, would be affected by monetary policy in this sense, because it's coming from energy prices, it's coming from oil prices, it's coming from a global supply crunch, it's coming from, as Andrew Sentence described it, all the fizz being let out the bottle in the recovery from coronavirus. And I don't think that any of those things would be dramatically changed by raising interest rates. So actually, I think the narrative of you need to raise interest rates to tackle that inflation is the wrong narrative. Markets had got very much ahead of themselves, 90% expectation that rates would rise. You've got to remember that the Bank of England's Monetary Policy Committee is made up of very serious economists who look at things very dispassionately, very seriously, and will probably be coming to the conclusion individually, and then they then collectively vote, that what I just said is what they feel, economically speaking. Raising the base rate won't do anything about soaring energy prices, external factors. There are some people who are extremely wise and extremely knowledgeable who disagree and think that we should have raised interest rates. One of those, Andrew Sentence, former member of the Bank of England's Monetary Policy Committee, currently a senior advisor at Cambridge Econometrics, was very critical of the Bank of England. And also the Bank of England's pattern of not raising interest rates. There is, I think, maybe a question to be asked whether the MPC is now structurally opposed to raising interest rates and whether that's something that dates all the way back to the post-financial crisis years. Because arguably, we could have got rates higher than we did before we had to start slashing them again. I mean, we had that little blip where we cut them after the Brexit vote as well. But we've been very, very fearful over raising rates. I guess the question is, what's the point of doing it? Well, in monetary policy, the idea is that this influences the cost of borrowing. So it influences the costs for banks, they pass the costs on to their customers. If you make borrowing more expensive, it makes it less attractive to borrow, which slows the economy. If you make borrowing cheaper, it makes it more attractive to borrow, which increases the speed of the economy. So you're trying to tackle inflation in that way, but it's a very blunt tool and it takes quite some time to take effect. As I said before, there are major questions over whether you can tackle things like energy prices, oil prices, and so on with it. So did they bottle it? I don't think they bottled it in that sense, because I didn't think they were going to raise rates. I would have been surprised if they were. Although I must admit, there was a moment of excitement yesterday that has rarely been felt on interest rate decision day since those heady days when interest rates used to actually change pre-financial crisis, where I was hitting that refresh button on the Bank of England's website, waiting for it to come through. It was like, oh, no, they've stuck. After all that, they've stuck. And then you have people talking about a nailed on rate rise in December. A 7-2 in this month, I'm not so sure nailed on at any time in the future is the description that we should be using.
So hearing what you're saying, the reason being given for why it was such a dead cert, or it will be such a dead cert, you don't actually think is correct, but you do think it was potentially the wrong decision. You do think now is the right time to start. Really, what are you saying there?
I'm saying that this was the wrong decision for the right reason. But maybe what the Bank of England needs to be communicating to people is that we should just not have interest rates at 0.1%, and that we need to start getting them up, start getting them towards normal, that was an emergency level, and that the emergency does not look anywhere near as bad as it did at that point, and we should start raising them. And that even if they raise rates by a small amount and gradually, costs of borrowing are not going to spiral. Mortgages, the best mortgages have been pulled. The best mortgages are still cheap, in many cases cheaper than they were before the pandemic. Businesses can still borrow, mainly, creditworthy, good businesses can still borrow at low rates. One of the problems in the economy is not really the rates on borrowing. It's the fact that people are cautious about borrowing, apart from in the housing market. That is definitely one place where I could see an argument for raising rates. But to go back to Andrew's sentence, I'm going to read something that he'd written for the Times, and this is going back before this, okay? So he was talking about inflation, and he said, why are we facing such a high surge in inflation when the economy was so suppressed for a long time during lockdowns? One view is that it's a bit like opening a bottle of fizzy drink you've just bought in the supermarket. It splatters all over the place and then subsides. That is the view of most central banks and governments around the world at the moment. In other words, we just have to ride out the storm. Inflation is different, though. There are times when there is a spike and it subsides, but that may not be the case on this occasion. We face inflationary pressures from so many different directions that the idea of persistent inflation must be taken seriously. So what should be done? Around the world, we have independent central banks committed to curbing inflation, like the Bank of England. They should be allowed to act independently and not be impeded by the court of public opinion. However, the Bank's Monetary Policy Committee appears to be handicapped by the court of public opinion. It has not responded at all to the emerging monetary policy threats, and so on. Ironically, though, it's been hung out to dry by the court of public opinion now for not raising rates. So they can't win.
Tanya, what are your views?
I agree that it was probably external factors with inflation that made the members of the monetary policy think, well, what impact are we really going to have? But there are problems with the economy. I mean, they do look ahead, and we are in a bit of a parlous position at the moment. They did explicitly refer to they wanted to see the ongoing impact of ending the furlough schemes. But they must realise that we're going to a potentially tricky winter. We may even have another lockdown. Cases are going up at the moment, are looking a bit tricky. And the economic situation may have had a big impact on what they were deciding.
I mean, you did kind of say at the start, like, if not now, when? When, Simon? Let's play that old favourite of our games.
Okay, so Andrew Bailey said, we do think interest rates will need to rise, and they will rise. And he said that his commitment to higher interest rates was meant to be heard in the financial markets and the country. That was deliberate. So what he was saying was, yeah, when I said to you interest rates are going to go up, I mean it. They are going to go up, they have to go up, and they will go up. This would be more meaningful if they were not at 0.1%. They obviously have to go up from 0.1%. Recent history tells us we might spend a long time waiting for that. And maybe that's the problem. Markets are absolutely convinced that rates won't rise. And that's why there's this concern over inflation and becoming embedded, because there is a, I think an overwhelming view that central banks will be complacent on inflation, and therefore inflation will be persistent, and therefore inflation might get out of control. So that's where the problem comes from. And that's what one of the reasons for raising interest rates is that, yes, it doesn't have much of an effect on these external issues, but it does send a signal we are serious about trying to curb inflation.
Yeah.
So I think maybe if everything's still looking okay come early next year, we might get one before spring. You know, late winter, early spring. I can't see us getting one this year. And if we get one then fair enough. You know, like a shift up to 0.25% is hardly going to make any difference. In all honesty, vast chunks of the mortgage market had already priced that in. Businesses, if a business can't handle an extra 0.15% in borrowing costs, if just that is passed on, you know, it could be that more is passed on, but even then, like, it's highly unlikely that the cost of business lending is going to go up by more than 0.5%, which is a reasonable amount, but it's not that much when you talk about it. And you have to remember that banks are in a really good financial position right now. They have got more money to lend out than people want to borrow. And the only reason that that hasn't been true is because of this weird pandemic property boom, partially fueled by the stamp duty break, all these other things that has meant that the mortgage market has been red hot. But if it wasn't for that, we'd be back to the situation that we were in before the pandemic, where their balance sheets still look good. They still had plenty of money to lend out, and they had less people wanting to borrow it than they did wanting to lend it out. So I don't think that actually raising interest rates would have too much of a crimping effect on the economy. And I just think it would be overall a wise move to start trying to get back to normal, because 2%, you know, that's historically low, but boy, does that look a long way away.
Yeah. I want to talk a bit more about mortgages. I said homeowners breathing a small sigh of relief, but actually, you know, whenever lenders get whiff of a rate rise, they do tend to act rather quickly. We did see over the past week mortgage rates edge up already in anticipation of it, a wave of lenders pulling their top rates. Yes, it's probably going to be a smidge. Yes, you can get super cheap deals still at the moment, Tanya, but the question that people are asking a lot is the era for cheap mortgages over?
I don't think so. If we're pushing off a rate rise a few more months, and I agree with Simon that it would probably be in the new year now, I think they'll want to wait until with interest rates until they've worked out what's going to happen with the pandemic and the impact on the economy, and they'll need to be well into the winter to be sure. Given that, I think that the people setting mortgage rates are going to have a, maybe a bit of a rethink. Meanwhile, the property market is still red hot. People, you know, are still taking the mortgage rates at the point that they're at.
So, I mean, you have an article on your website talking about, you know, what should those with standard variable rate mortgages or nearing the end of their fixed rate deal do at the moment? What should they do?
Look for a new mortgage. There you go, done. No, look, so this, the first thing to bear in mind is that mortgage rates are still cheap, and they are very cheap, in fact. They're not as cheap as they were. You could fix for 5 years for less than 1% if you had a whacking great big deposit or equity in your home, which is quite astonishing, really. But you can still fix for 5 years for about 1.2%, which is super cheap. Inflation is running at 3.1%. That means that effectively, any mortgage rate below 3.1% is negative in real terms. It means that actually the value of that loan is being eroded faster than you're paying interest on it. Really, though, I don't think it's inflation that matters to people in that sense. It's more what is their ability to pay that mortgage coming from? Well, it's coming from their earnings. Now, if their earnings are going up at a faster rate than their mortgage, again, then you could say that that's negative in real terms. And for many people, that will be the case. Obviously, if you have a smaller deposit, then your mortgage rate is going to be higher. But even then, you might only be paying like 2.5-3%. The issue is for people on standard variable rates who might be paying their lender's standard rate that they've slipped onto after a fixed rate deal. And they could be paying 4% or more. Now, they could save money instantly by switching their mortgage to a fix and stave off the threat of a rate rise. And there's not many people out there for whom it wouldn't be a good idea to shift off the standard variable rate. The only reason to not to do that would be if you thought you were going to either have to pay off your mortgage soon or move home soon and you don't want to get hit by early repayment charges. But in that instance, you could try to find a deal that doesn't come with early repayment charges. For fixed rates, those are very few and far between, but they do exist. You'll pay a premium for it, but they do exist. But a tracker rate might be another option. There are lifetime trackers out there that have no early repayment charges, and you could take one of those. So anybody on a standard variable rate should definitely consider moving because they will save money. Anybody coming to the end of a fixed rate should speak to a broker and act now. Don't just speak to your own bank because they'll only give you their own rates. You can go looking around yourself. If you go to thisismoney.co.uk/mortgage-finder, or just go to thisismoney.co.uk/mortgages, which is easier, you'll find our mortgage calculator, which is powered by a broker, L&C. What it enables you to do is put the value of your house in, put the size of your mortgage in, put how long you want to fix for, put what the term is, and it will show you what the cheapest deals are that you could apply for. Now, if you want an easy life, could then go through L&C. They're a fee-free broker. We've got a partnership with them because we think they're good. Or you could go elsewhere. You could go straight to the bank. You could go straight to the building site if you want to. But they'll still own. They'll only offer you their rates, whereas a broker will look at the whole of the market and crucially not just say to you, well, this is the cheapest one. They'll say, well, this is the one that's probably going to suit you best for the other reasons that you've given me, because they do have to ask you a load of questions about various stuff. And it might not just be that the cheapest rate is, or the lowest monthly payments, or the cheapest over the 2 years is best for you. There might be other factors at play. Or they might say there's something about your circumstances that means you won't get it with that lender, but you will get it with this lender. But if you're coming towards the end of a fixed rate or a tracker deal or any other kind of deal, if it's in the next 3 or 6 months, speak to a broker, because most banks and building societies will let you book into a rate 3 months in advance. And actually some will let you book into it 6 months in advance and will hold it for you for that long. And it's probably likely that in 3 or 6 months, mortgage rates might be higher than they are now. You never know. This might be a blip and they might be lower. But they're so low now that it makes sense to do that. And then what you say is that you want to, you don't want to pay the arrangement fee up front, that you say you want to add it to the loan. That will make it more expensive over the long term, but then you just pay it off immediately when you take out the loan. And by doing that, you've locked into the rate. You haven't spent any money, you've made no financial commitment, and you can still pull out. So if mortgage rates come down, you can swap to a cheaper rate. But if they don't come down, you've locked into that rate. So it would definitely pay to do the legwork if you're coming to the end of your mortgage.
I want to talk about house prices. Now, that's a lie. I never want to talk about house prices. But they've been around, you know, we've been talking about them this week. Apparently, during the pandemic, the average price of a house in the UK has gone up 30 grand. Simon, your latest piece, though, is asking, is rampant house price inflation about to rapidly decline? And why does the OBR say the pandemic boom will make homes cheaper? Will it? What did you find?
It's weird that, isn't it? Like a spike in inflation that makes homes cheaper. The OBR in its budget documents had a chart that looked at its predictions March 2020, March 2021, October 21 for house price inflation, and also house prices versus wages, which is the important thing. And the OBR suggested that had we not had the pandemic property boom, then house prices would have risen more gradually, but would have then just kept going. In fact, the rate of inflation would have picked up, and that would have actually made them more expensive when we look out maybe like 3 or 4 years versus wages than the wild pandemic property boom that we've seen, which has seen a dramatic and sudden surge in inflation, but that is expected by the OBR to now drop away back down to about 1% house price inflation from double digits at the moment in 2023, and then only very slowly climb back up to 4%.
Tanya, your views before we move away from this whole subject and onto pensions?
This pandemic house price boom is quite unbelievable, really. I think it shows the influence of human nature on people's decision. You know, we talk a lot about the figures here, but I really think a lot of the people who spent a lot of time in their homes, they pulled their decisions to move forward. I think the OBR made reference to this as well, that a lot of the activity is house moves that have been brought forward. And in some ways, yes, that boom was unexpected, but in other ways, completely relatable. And you can understand why people became desperate to move, really, as soon as the lockdown allowed them to start going out and viewing houses.
I'm in that area. I've just moved to that area where just outside of London that people want to live. And presumably a lot of people don't need to go into London anymore. That's why they're here. And I've noticed around the area, the number of WeWork type places that are opening up, and also queues at coffee shops at 8:30, 9 o'clock when you'd expect people to be at work. It's changing the face of the high street.
I mean, we've talked about this drain from city centres, but it's also been good for places outside of city centres. And actually, in a lot of those places outside of city centres, maybe you'll find some more independent businesses, less chains. I think that might be wishful thinking if you walk down most high streets in the country, but they're packed with the usual coffee shops, etc. But it is slightly changing how we spend our money. And I don't think it's sucking money out of the economy. I think it's just being directed into different places. And the one thing I would say about the whole pandemic property boom is it looks like absolute insanity that it even happened in the first place when the expectation was the market would fall. Yeah. But then there was the stamp duty thing, the talk about the false economy because prices had gone up so much that you were paying more than the tax and so on and so on. But the real element here is that more people have moved home, right? Lots more people have moved home, and lots of people are now happy that they've moved home and then they're in their new home. And yes, maybe they spent a bit more than they should have done on it. If people really, really overspent, they could get in trouble. But lots of people are happy that they moved home and they got to move home, and they might have struggled to move home in the years before. I moved home, but that's actually because I had already sold my property just before the pandemic started, and otherwise I wouldn't have had anywhere to live. But other members of my family have moved home and they're very happy that they've moved to new houses. And there are all over the country, there are lots of people that are happy they've moved to new houses, and they're out there spending money in the economy, doing stuff to buy things for those houses or improve those houses. And so, you know, overall, it's a good thing for the economy. But yeah, people have probably spent a bit too much on the properties themselves.
Indeed. All right, we're going to move away from this and on to much more, well, emotive subject now. I mean, ever since This Is Money exclusively revealed in September that there was a service meltdown at WP, Tania et al. Have been inundated with messages from older people struggling to get state pension payments started or end deferments. Readers have reported woeful incompetence, repeated broken promises to call them back by DWP staff, but most distressing of all is the stories of hardship faced by these people who are waiting for their money. And by the way, this is a separate issue to the more than 100,000 elderly women who are underpaid the estimated $1 billion in state pension, by the way. Steve Webb, This Is Money's pension agony uncle, partner at LCP, and former pensions minister. Steve, remind us of what happened. Remind us what this is all about. Thank you for joining us.
It's a pleasure, George. I mean, so you kind of assume that you're coming up to pension age, you get a letter from the department saying in a few months' time you can draw your pension if you want to, here's how to go about it. And you don't have to take your pension at pension age, that's an option, but they do generally send you a warm-up letter some months ahead. And you'd assume if you filled in the paperwork when you got it, you'd get your pension when it was due. And it's a useful reminder to say that what I mean by when it's due is 4 weeks after you reach pension age. So the first payment's normally about a month after, covers that first four-week period. So a month after pension age, that's kind of how it works. But what we're talking about here is people waiting 3 months, 4 months, longer, phoning up, chasing, people getting no paperwork in reply. It's like the canary in the cage. They contact This Is Money, we hear them in their ones and twos. Tanya writes a story and suddenly hundreds of people read it and say, yes, that's me. And we realise that this isn't just, you know, one person's file's gone down the back of a filing cabinet. It's something systematic going on.
Like what? What was going on? What happened?
Yeah, what seems to have been happening is that although this is a separate story to all those underpaid state pensions, departments don't have armies of civil servants sitting doing nothing, ready to be, you know, like bringing in the army to deal with food shortages. There's just a stock of civil servants. And if you put experts on state pensions onto tracking down underpaid ones in one bit of the department, they're not on the front line processing new state pension claims. And so it looks to us as though at least part of the story here is the people who really understood state pensions were doing this difficult, backward-looking stuff, and the day-to-day business wasn't being done properly. New people were doing it, probably weren't as well trained. And it just meant things got out of hand and got behind.
Has it been sorted out now? Are we back to the 4 weeks as we should be?
Well, yes and no, I think, is the answer to that. So the government, first of all, didn't really tell anybody about this. It was only when we started asking questions that they admitted that there was a problem. They said it was sorted by the end of October. And what they claim now is that new claims will be processed in that normal window and that the backlog has been cleared with a but. And the but is 4,900 people who they say further information was required. So a simple case would be, I could have taken my pension last year, I put it off for a year, I now claim, and they have to do some extra calculations, or if I put off for a long time and I can choose a lump sum or extra pension. So they come back to you with some questions, you have to go back to them with the answers, then they can process it. And what they're saying is there's nearly 5,000 people who haven't got their pensions yet who are still waiting. But we know that some of these, you know, yes, they may have deferred, but they deferred till they needed their pension. And months later, they still haven't got that money. And DWP have as good as admitted that that's still the case.
A few months, Tanya, without getting your pension. What are people doing?
We've had some really awful stories come in. And since we published the last story, we have had about half a dozen more cases, which we'll look at. The story that we published this week was a really upsetting one. We had focused on two people, one of whom literally didn't have enough food to eat for 4 months because he had no income. He had a council support worker because his benefits had stopped. And the council support worker, it sounds like he really tried to help him, but he was living on food parcels. And he says that he lost 4 stone. I mean, that is a terrible state of affairs to get into when you are owed a state pension and you're not being paid it through no fault of your own. The other lady that we highlighted, her housing benefit stopped, plus a disability benefit stopped. She'd had a traumatic brain injury 11 years ago, so she was unable to work, and so she was reliant on this money. When it stopped and months went by without, again, any income, she was forced to borrow from her daughter to pay her rent. She was worried about losing her home if her daughter couldn't carry on helping her, and you can see how that kind of situation couldn't necessarily go on indefinitely. She was absolutely at the end of her tether when she contacted us. These are the stories that we've published, but I think it's fair to say that we've had an awful lot of messages from people who we haven't yet helped, managed to help, or who have had their cases resolved, but had an absolutely terrible time. A lot of people have said, I cried on the phone, I begged DWP to help me. I mean, this is an awful situation when you think these people are waiting for money that they're actually owed. One lady reported to me in an email that she'd been told by a DWP member of staff to go to a food bank. Now, that's really disgusting. She was very, very upset by this, as you can understand. She said, I donate to food banks to be put in a position where I was being told to go to one myself through no fault of my own because I hadn't been paid my state pension. She was absolutely distraught in her message to us, as a lot of people have been.
Steve, some awful stories there. You listened to hours of the Public Accounts Committee last Thursday, I understand, with DWP, civil servants, talking about this issue. What did you make of it?
Well, they were very much problem what problem, you know, we promise we'll sort it out. We check the numbers daily, they're coming down, you know, we don't think there's a problem. And I passed on to the committee some evidence that we'd had of people who ring up, and then they ring up again. And the person they speak to says, oh, I'm sorry, you know, I'm in a call centre, I work for a contractor firm, I can't see the main computer, or I've got no record of your previous call, or, you know, they promise a call back and it never happens. And the civil servants were like, oh no, we don't, that shouldn't happen, you know, do give us some examples, you know. And it's a disconnect between the people at the top of the organization and the front line. And in a sense, what this is money is doing is taking the temperature of the nation. It's actually finding out what's happening in real people's real lives. And we're going to feed with permission. So we'll get permission from people and feed some cases back through the committee to the department, say, oh, look, this is what's really happening on the ground. I think the other thing that strikes me is department is so secretive, is the only word I can use. You know, instead of making a statement to Parliament in the summer saying, look, we're really sorry, we've discovered that we've realised we're paying state pensions late, here's how many are outstanding, here's the plan, they just keep their heads down until, you know, we prod and probe and rock the story. And, you know, even the other week, they published some figures and I sent them a little email saying, can I have a bit more information? And they said, no, we'll update you next year sometime. And it's just, you know, things do go wrong in bureaucracies, but they should be open and transparent about it.
So what should you do if you are in this situation, Steve?
Well, something that emerged through all of this is we're familiar with what are called special payments or kind of benefit advances on universal credit. So because universal credit, like the state pension, is paid in arrears, people whose money's stopped can be short of cash this week. So for universal credit, there's a system whereby you get, you know, a week's money now rather than waiting a month. And what certainly I hadn't realised till recently is that there's the same with the state pension. In principle, you could ring up, ring a number, make your case for you know, just for some money, for just some money on account. But I didn't know that. And frankly, the call handler who told the lady to go to the food bank presumably didn't know that. So what use is an emergency payment system if even the call handlers don't signpost to it? So I'll probably table the Freedom of Information request, ask how many they've paid. It'd probably be, you know, seven or something. Or they'll refuse to answer because it costs them too much to tell me the truth.
Well, meanwhile, after an absolute barrage of criticism and calls for a rethink, the government has performed a U-turn, sticking with pensions, over rules for a pension age rise from 55 to 57 in 2028. Now, industry experts had warned the plan was confusing and a gift to scammers. Tanya, you're going to have to explain this one for us.
In some pension schemes, the age that you can take your pension is written into the agreement. And there was a worry raised by a lot of people in the industry that people who wanted to stick with age 55 to get their retirement money would unnecessarily maybe, or with inducements from scammers, try to transfer. And there was a very generous, shall we say, window, as they described, they called it a window, until 2023 when people could have done this. And basically what's happened this week is that the government has suddenly slammed the window shut and said, unless you actually got a transfer in train to a scheme with a 55 age limit, then you can't do it. It is probably the case that it will head off scammers. But there's still a great deal of confusion. The experts that we talked to for this story said, okay, well, fine, that's okay. But there's still going to be a lot of people out there with pots, some of which they can take at 55, some of which they can take at 57. Sometimes they might even be in the same scheme and some of their money they can take at 55 and some at 57. I have to say that I haven't really got my head around that. Maybe Steve can shed some light on how that could happen, because I don't understand how that could be the case when all the government really wants to do is move the age when you can start taking your private pensions from 55 to 57. We quoted Tom Selby from AJ Bells, who said the government has made a colossal meal out of this rule change. The situation we're still in now is actually quite ludicrous, even though they have closed this one window this week. But perhaps Steve can explain a bit more about this. He did do a column about it for us a couple of months ago.
Yeah, sure. I mean, so the idea is that you can get your private pension 10 years before pension age in general terms. So when male pension age was 65, the figure was 55, that sort of made sense. As pension age has gone up, now 66, soon 67, the government said, oh, well, we better raise the 55 to 57 to keep it in step. And that, you see the logic of that. But of course, people have got money in existing pension pots, and some of them say, well, you can access it at whatever age the government says you can access it at, which will now be 57, and that's simple. But some will say 55. It will have the numbers in the rules, which means you can access at 55 regardless of what the government has done. And so you've got this weird situation where it's a lottery of the rules of the scheme you're in. Frankly, I've got several pensions I don't know. I'm going to have to ring my former employer, Royal London, at some point and say, you know, my pension, is it a 55 pension or a 57 pension? Because I haven't read the rules. I mean, I've just saved some money with them. I haven't read the rules of the pension. And I think the possibility of having two with different ages could be, for example, say something like Nest, for example, the government scheme has got millions and millions of members. And if you work for a company that uses Nest as its workplace pension, you change jobs, you work for another company that uses Nest, they set up a separate account for you. So that would be, you could have two pensions with the same provider. Now, Nest rules are probably the same in all cases, but you can see how you could end up with multiple pensions with one scheme, and because of an accident of date or change of rules, you'd end up with one on what, 55, one on 57. And, you know, to be honest, I kind of wonder why they bothered with all this. I mean, the number of people who cash out their entire retirement at 55 and is negligible, I suspect.
I think that people in the pensions industry would still like further work on this by the Treasury. We'll have to see what happens. They've made one move. It may well be that they will have to make other practical adjustments. We will just have to watch and wait and see. 2028 is quite a long way away. We have included in our current story, which is at the top of the pensions page, a whole list of things people can do if they are in their late 40s and are going to be affected by this. this and still want to retire at 55, but will have to wait until they're 57 to tap their pots. There is some pre-planning you can do now. And if that is something that you want to do, then you should get started thinking about it, even though it's still quite a long way off. Let's hope the government irons out these problems before it actually happens.
Steve, thank you very much for joining us. We really appreciate it. You and, I believe, your golden retriever.
She's got bored with hearing me talk about pensions yet again.
She passed out on the floor there. It's brilliant. Steve, thank you. Much appreciated. Meanwhile, Tanya, just one final pensions story. The Lords are asking the government to look again at the pensions triple lock suspension. So should pensioners get their hopes up?
Probably not, to be absolutely honest. What's happened is that the government, because of various distortions in the labour market, wage growth was really at a very high level, 8.3% it would have been. That would have been a massive increase in the state pension. They've decided, as a result, the government, to make it a double lock this year and take that element out of it. So now it's going to be 3.1%. Rise for pensioners next April, which is obviously a lot less. They are very upset about it. Our read polls have showed overwhelming support for getting the full whack. And what's happened in the Lords this week is that there's been a rebellion led by former pensions minister Ros Altman. And what they are basically asking for is stick with the triple lock, but adjust the wages figure. I think there's a recognition that 8.3% is a non-starter, but the idea would be, for example, the forecast for inflation next year is around 4%. So maybe edge it up a bit more in that direction by adjusting the way you calculate the wages growth element of triple lock. Then you can say you've kept the triple lock. Then you can say I've kept my manifesto commitment. The reason I've suggested people should contain their hopes is that this is a financial matter and the House of Lords can amend it, but House of Commons does have final say on financial matters, and so it's fairly straightforward to overturn it. And I think it's unlikely that they'll think again. But it may well be that there's enough of a head of steam, you know, built up. You know, Ros is an influential player. She's just won a separate victory on another front for very low paid people saving into pensions. And if she gets enough people on side, it is possible that she could, you know, force them to put it up at least to what inflation is likely to be next year. Otherwise, people are not only very upset now, they are extremely upset about what they see as a betrayal, but that is only going to get worse next year when if inflation is 4% or even 5%, as we've mentioned earlier in this podcast, and pensioners get their 3.1% and are really struggling with bills. At that point, politically, they might think, well, I wish we'd listened to Ros back last autumn. Frankly, we'll have to see.
We will indeed. Finally, why do Nottingham residents pay £1,400 more council tax than Westminster ones? With bills set to rise even further next April, This Is Money have delved into the mysterious and frankly quite mad world of council tax and how the levy is set. Simon, what's going on? Council tax.
Council tax is slightly insane and is quite antiquated and outdated and hasn't been sorted out for many years, largely because there was a suggestion that there was going to be this huge revaluation exercise where people were worried it was going to involve them paying more tax. Rightly so, because there was definitely going to be some rigmarole that involved meaning that more people were probably bumped into the upper bands than into the lower bands and they would end up paying more tax. The system itself is nuts because the vast majority of council tax, as we learn when we go to journalism school and do our local politics stuff, and anybody who ever learns about this stuff will know, goes not to your council, but it goes into a central pot where it is then redistributed around the country by the government. But it's also nuts because it's in the way that it's set by the council. You have some councils that absolutely pin themselves to super low council tax, and there's a number of London councils that do this. and others in areas that are considerably less wealthy than places like Westminster, Kensington and Chelsea, Hammersmith and Fulham, Wandsworth and the City of London, where council tax is much higher. Rightmove ran the numbers. We've done a report on this. So the places with the cheapest council tax is Westminster now. It's £829 a year for Band D. £829 for Band D. That's pretty cheap. Now, it used to be Wandsworth that always used to be the cheapest. That's now 845. City of London's 845. Hammersmith and Fulham, 1,196. Kensington and Chelsea, 1,331. And then you look at the places with the most expensive and you get Nottingham, 2,226. This is a Band D property. And a Band D property in Nottingham is going to be worth a lot less money than a Band D property in Westminster. Not every single person living in Westminster is rich. That must be said. There are still some areas within central London where people live in local authority housing. Not everybody is rich, okay? But they are disproportionately more likely to be substantially wealthy than the people living in Nottingham. Newark and Sherwood, £2,171. Robin Hood, not going to be happy about that one. Dorset, £2,223. Rutland, £2,195. Lewes, £2,189. And that means that those people are paying, you know, substantially more. And Rightmove ran the numbers on the places with the highest council tax as a proportion of annual mortgage bills. So this is a reflection of the fact that houses are cheap, but the council tax is expensive. And the place that came out top there was Middlesbrough, where £2,104 Band D council tax, but average annual mortgage bills would only be £6,119. So that's 34%. The problem with the council tax and the revaluation thing is that houses were placed into bands based on their kind of location, size, value. Okay. What their value was considered to be. Mm-hmm. Now, a lot of those houses have changed substantially since then. They've been extended. They may be much, much bigger than they were 30 years ago in 1991. The locations don't change, obviously. Most people don't move their house. But some locations become more desirable. Some locations become less desirable. That would be a slower shifting thing. You have the scenario where you have people in upper bands who only have maybe, who have houses in the same band as them that are worth a multiple of their house. And I'm going to give you a personal example here because I was talking about council tax, funnily enough, with my wife and my in-laws only about a month ago when I had discovered that my house was in the same council tax band as my mum's. My mum's house is quite a lot bigger than mine. We're in the band below the top, right? Okay, we're in band G, and I pay £3,253 a year, right? It's £271 a month. It's a lot of money. Band D for that is £1,952. Now, you're much...
Lick your bins clean for that.
Yeah, you are much... The way that the bands work as well, that they're structured, certainly for my council, is that I'm three bands from the middle, right? From band D, okay? Right. Okay. If you go back, and that's paying something like 66% more than it. If you go backwards three bands, then you're much closer to it. So it's sort of asymmetrically structured. But the problem is there's only one band above me. And so the one band above me, they pay £3,904. So they pay £650 more a year. So they are paying, you know, more than me. But some of those houses around here, I mean, we're talking about people living in like £4-5 million houses in this area that I live in. I live on the commuter belt outside of London, and they're where, you know, not all of those people in that band would be in them. Maybe, but they're probably all in like £1 million+, you know, houses and stuff like that. Some of those houses, though, like we're talking mega mansions, and the people living in the mega mansions, I mean, the most expensive house for sale within the St. Albans area, which is the big area that I live in at the moment, is £8.5 million. That's the most expensive house on the open market. That will be in Band H. right? They would only pay the £650 more than all the people who live in, you know, smaller suburban houses, yeah, like I do, kind of thing. So this is why people argue that we need a revaluation, because actually at the top end, there's been this whole extra level of top end that's on top of it. So if you go back to the Kensington and Chelsea one, you know, for example, the houses in the top band in Kensington and Chelsea are the houses in the most expensive roads in the country. They might be worth £50 million. They might be worth more. Yet they're only in that top band in Kensington and Chelsea, and they'll be paying the same amount of council tax as maybe a place that is worth a fraction of that. And that's obviously an extreme example, but this kind of thing happens in towns, cities, all over the country. Even if you go to the areas of the country where house prices are much lower, you will find that there are people in those bands, those upper bands, who are paying a certain amount, and that there's then somebody living in a house that is an order of magnitude more expensive than theirs, paying either the same amount or only one band higher. Will we ever get that revaluation? I don't know. Everybody's shied away from it. They're very nervous about it and putting up people's bills. Then they're also super nervous about it because there was a tax that came before council tax, and that was called poll tax. And yeah, that did not make people happy.
It seems to me that we've just been discussing this, Tanya, for quite some time about revamping council tax. It doesn't seem very fair. What Simon Sorter's sounding like there is a property tax. Again, quite a difficult thing to do, given the fact that different areas become popular or not popular. Are we going to be changing this all the time? Is the government going to be sending around a load of people to value all our homes? I mean, it seems like a sensible thing to do to change this. But there's quite a lot on the government's plate at the moment. So you're reckoning it's not high on the agenda?
Oh, I'm sure it's not high on the agenda at all. The thing is that it's based on prices in 1991. And although you wouldn't necessarily want them to be doing it every 5 minutes, maybe every decade or so, having another look at what properties are worth and what the bands are is not within, you know, beyond the realms of possibility. One of the problems with this, and another thing that really skews it, is that some councils get a lot of income from services, business rates and so on, and some don't. And also, some councils have to provide a lot of very serious services, like child services, and which are not only very important but also statutory. And so therefore they've got a lot more absolutely essential bills to pay, for want of a better way of putting it, and they're getting less, you know, money in through income. Council tax is actually quite complicated. There are all sorts of, you know, rules placed on councils. They can't just do what they like and set what they want. Ones that do might easily get into trouble, not least with their voters. But if they're not going to do a proper revaluation, and you can understand why the government would think it was such a nightmare, and the poll tax has got, you know, fiasco has got them so scared that they don't want to do that, there surely must be a better way of assessing local councils and what their needs are, what their income is, and do it in a non-party political way, so that councils don't have to, you know, whack the bills up quite so much.
But the problem with the council tax thing is it leads to headlines like "Pay more tax because you've got a nice garden." Right. Okay. But actually, if you have a nice garden, that's theoretically mean your house is worth more and things like that. It's like pay more tax, you've got a nice house. But if you pay more tax because you've got a nice house, that is how council tax actually works. The problem is just those houses have changed, and there is a whole like strata of houses that are now like top end houses compared to what they used to be. But the controversial thing I was going to say is that actually there are people out there who will tell you that they thought the poll tax was a better idea than council tax, because for all of the problems it caused and the huge riots and the complaints about it and the way that it was done, which wasn't very well, it was done on the number of adults in the household. And your house doesn't have the ability to pay the tax. It's the, if you have working adults in the household, they have the ability to pay the tax. Now, that's not exactly how the poll tax worked, but there are still some people out there who will say to you, well, actually, I thought the poll tax was better.
Tanya, you just put your hand up there.
What Simon said about gardens, one of the things about the sort of the skewed incentives that councils have when they can't put up council tax anymore or think they can't, and they're not getting enough money from the central government, is that people with gardens, you know, suddenly face absolutely insane bills for stupid things like taking away garden waste, absolutely stratospheric bill for that in my area, and also the very, very cheap bag that can't cost more than about 5p to make, that costs like 10 quid or something. I have some sympathy because they need to pay their bills, and they need to pay for very important services, but then they will just kind of really, really stiff you on this other stuff. And people with gardens in my area, yes, they are definitely the losers.
We're paying a fortune now this year. They introduced that for the garden waste collection, which is sort of it's basically just encourages loads of people to fly tip, I think, is one of the problems with these such schemes. The other thing that people have a real problem with councils is that councils have a real issue with sticking to their knitting and just providing the essential services that people need and expect. Instead, they have reams of people who are dedicated to just meddling with stuff. Meddling with parking is like the one that drives people absolutely up the wall, whether it's residential parking outside their houses, whether it's, you know, pedestrianising streets, unpedestrianising streets. And COVID has delivered an absolute boom in council meddling on this stuff. Meanwhile, you can't find an off-road cycle route or path between a town and a village, but oh no, they can keep changing the parking all the time. So you can see why people get grumpy about paying so much money.
Council tax. It's that thing that sounds quite boring, but it really gets us going. I mean, literally, it's between one to the other of you two. Tanya, what now? What's going on?
The main road near my house has been narrowed, widened, narrowed again, and now widened again. It's just constant. Every few years, they change their mind and decide it needs to be a different size.
I'm sure it's a great use of your council tax money. That's it. We've got to stop it there. I haven't even waded in on this one. You can keep up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app if you have any comments or questions to the team or anything you'd like them to look into. Simon?
You can tweet us at thisismoney. Come to thisismoney.co.uk/podcast to join the debate and read the comments. And you can send us any questions, comments, etc. marked podcast in the subject line to editor@thisismoney.co.uk.
And if you like our podcast, why not rate us on iTunes? It helps people find us.